Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
This is Bob Hill.
And we are on location at Caudill Seed. If you drive downtown, you see the building with the Caudill Seed Company painted on the side of it. I think, can you see it from the expressway too?
If you stand on your roof.
If you stand on your roof, or you're in a really big truck.
Roof of your car.
But yeah, it's something, it's like a fixture somehow. It's always there.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize to what extent they were here.
Yeah, among the things they are is the largest seller of microwave popcorn in North America, mm-hmm. United States.
Yeah.
Among other things. Yeah, a buddy of mine, Carl Gehring, who I played poker with and lose a lot of money to, and he mentioned over the years what an interesting place this was, and I bought seat here from time to time. But until you walk in the building mm-hmm. and see the hundreds of thousands yeah. of square feet of what they're doing, you don't appreciate it.
Somewhat of a campus, you know, on two sides of the street of West Main here, a couple of different divisions where, you know, you have agricultural seed, the actual yeah. old-fashioned seed part to it, then a whole other division where you have organic food, and as Bob said, microwavable popcorn is one of their biggest sellers, so there's a lot to it than just the whole,
yeah. and all
what
of
meets
it,
the eye.
A lot of it in 150-year-old buildings.
Yeah.
Which makes it all
cool.
more interesting.
And they haven't even been here that long.
No.
So anyway, we're excited to be here. We're going to take a tour with Del Thacker, who's the chief operating officer for their whole alternatives division, which is the organic and all natural food division. And then Joe Lyons, he oversees their plantwise division and manages the CS health division, which is more the seed side of it and like sprouting right. seeds as well as agricultural seeds, etc. So
exactly.
pretty interesting.
Yep.
So stick with us. We're going to take a tour of Caudill Seed. They've been in business for 60 some odd years, second generation still in the family. So there's some good Louisville history to it as well. Bob, before we get to that, what is going on in your garden?
Well, I've got a mea culpa, believe it or not, a pronunciation
oh, yeah?
mea culpa.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. One of my favorite throwaway guys is Pliny the Elder.
Mm-hmm.
And a woman caught me.
Uh-huh.
It's Pliny.
Pliny the Elder.
Pliny the Elder and Pliny the Junior or the Younger.
Mm-hmm.
So I apologize to all you ancient Romans out there. I'll never say Pliny again. It's Pliny.
I think I probably have always said Pliny too.
Yeah. Well, you look at that and you say, you want to
say
Pliny. You
want
to
say Pliny because
it's
we don't really speak Latin.
And, I've learned my lesson.
All right.
How about
good.
The Worcester State?
So
what's
it's
up?
Pliny. Well, I'm pruning blueberries. This is a good
oh,
time of
yeah.
the year to prune blueberries. You can really see the shrub, you
oh, yeah.
know what I mean? Because there aren't any leaves on there. And I know you've got new bushes, but we've got some bushes that have been there for 15, 20 years.
I'll trade you.
And if you don't get all of that old stuff cleaned out from time to time, you're not going to have very good production. In fact, I think you want, how big is that, do you think?
About a quarter acre.
Yeah.
No, she's got,
no it's about as, what, about a quarter size, penny size?
Yeah, penny nickel, okay. somewhere there.
You don't want branch, that's sort of the ideal branch size in terms of production. So anything that's bigger than that,
no.
you really want to get rid of. So that's, it's actually a huge job for us right now, but that's what I'm doing.
I'm looking forward to that problem.
Yeah. Well, you'll have it soon enough.
I hope
you'll
so.
You'll have it soon
yeah.
enough. All right. There's some things going on around town. Let's see. Bernheim is having a pretty cool sounding event on Saturday, January 17th. It's called Extraordinary Rocks. Basically, they'll talk about different stones, rocks, etc. Look at arrowheads, projectile points, axes, other tools. They'll do some flint napping as well, so it's probably something that kids would really enjoy. But that's January 17th. I'm out at Bernheim. You can go to their website or our website at wfpl.org for more information.
Yeah, Bernheim's an old legendary place around here, as is.
As okay. is
Caudill Seed. Called Caudill Seed Company.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking, because, you know, we so often have talked about buying local and all of that. And I've heard people discuss the dilemma between organics versus local products, et cetera. And this is sort of the other side of it, you know, local business, but it's the bigger side of the whole sort of Whole Foods
yep.
business as well. But they started out in agricultural areas first. Suburbia, I guess, can take a little credit for the inception.
They are practicing what we preach.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Lyons describes himself as a lifetime denizen of nurseries, garden centers, and greenhouses, a passion interrupted only by education-related employment in financial and marketing professions. He now directs the Caudill Seed Plantwise Division and also helps manage the Caudill Seed Health Division. Joe, welcome to Homegrown.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm,
sure.
I'm a listener, I believe, from the beginning.
Okay. That always helps.
Yeah.
It's great to be here, and we welcome you to Caudill Seed.
Thank
you.
You
know what you're dealing with.
Yes.
Let's begin with an overview of the company. Give us a brief rundown of the history of the place and kind of the reach of the Caudill Seed Company?
Well, actually, the business was started in 1947, right after Second World War. Our founder, Forrest Caudill, returned from the Army and was looking for something to do, like many other doughboys and other folks returning from the war. And started to, you know, very observant person, and started seeing neighborhoods pop up, you know, the whole model of post-World War II home building, and decided that, you know, these folks are going to need seed, and they're going to need lawns, etc., and what better place to do it than Kentucky.
Had he had any experience in that sort of business, or was it just really an entrepreneurial spirit to...
There was a tremendous amount of experience, much like mine. Not terribly formal, but the man knew his stuff from the ground up, and no pun intended.
So it started with grass seed, and then eventually evolved into...
It just started to expand. A lot of it was not our doing. Grass seeds and turf seeds largely became under the control in the late 50s, 60s of the major seed companies. So you had very little option but to purchase their seed, repackage it if you like, and be a big distributor, which we were for a number of years. And slowly but surely, you know, some of the big producers start squeezing out distributors left and right. And I think really testimony to our 62 years in business or whatnot is largely due to our forward thinking and how well we could diversify the company to make, you know, not leave any business behind, but to add more as we continue to grow. And that's what we've been very successful in doing.
Yeah, let's talk about the farm agriculture business and the immense reach of the Caudill Seed Company in that area.
Wow, it's just about everywhere right now. Our primary seed division, which is housed here in Kentucky, we also have two locations in Moorhead and Allen, distribute farm seed, vegetable seeds, crop seeds, forage seeds, turf seeds from those three locations. It's pretty wide. The actual distribution territory, though, does go beyond Kentucky boundaries. So we're doing a great deal of business now in Tennessee, Western Virginia, a big part of West Virginia itself, Western Pennsylvania, Southern Ohio, pretty much all the state of Indiana, and just draw a big circle around us.
Can you put a number on that, like how many bags of seed or how many pounds of seed, to give listeners an idea of the scope of this company?
Wow, that's hard to tell. I can tell you this, that we probably saddle up 20 tons a day, 21 tons a day when we're in season, onto about 100 trucks daily and start distributing.
So
the numbers are just blow you away, I think, in terms of quantities.
So we can sort of consider the Louisville location and some of these other places distribution centers, but where are you actually getting the seed? Are growers growing specifically for you? Do you have to search far and wide so that you have the supplies that you need to then distribute?
There's a number of ways to do that. As first and foremost, as a seed distributor, we're always scouring the planet for seeds that'll work for us or to satisfy a particular need we may have or a customer may have. And that just involves, you know, attending some of the larger trade shows, et cetera, for seed, and then making deals with one company to another, you know. Very rarely now are we buying commodities on the open market, but we are working independently with specific larger producers to satisfy us. At the same time, we do have farms in operation under our control and or ownership in a number of locations. And we do quite a bit of seed breeding for ourselves as well. So we're getting as vertically integrated as we can from the growth stage to the actual distribution point.
So seed breeding, I would suspect, takes a little more of a scientific approach to it. How do you all start to develop your own types of seeds?
First of all, we kind of assess what we may need. That may be a function of how much seed in a particular variety may be available for the coming year. There were several years we've had fescue shortages, et cetera, et cetera. So any action we can take in advance of that to shore up our supply is what we do. And we've had a very long-standing relationship with Dr. Virginia Lehman. She's now with her own facility called Blue Moon Farms in Oregon. She's been involved in seed breeding, I don't want to say forever, but extremely intelligent. I believe she was involved with the first breeding of Rebel seed. And everything we do is crossbred. We don't do a lot of genetic engineering at all. So It takes quite a bit of time.
Okay.
We've done 8 years of experimenting.
So just looking for a better seed, whether it's a turf seed or some sort of vegetable seed, just, you know, looking for a better seed, then you guys will have sort of ownership of that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Mm-hmm. There's what's called a plant variety protection, and it offers the breeder and the grower some protection from others using that particular seed. And usually for this area, we're breeding to meet, you know, multiple season type things. The transition zone in Kentucky, or of which Kentucky is a part, is a difficult place for growing nice turf.
So you'll actually blend several seeds together to get a good turf grass?
We will do that, and we've done that with our Triple Crown blend that has been, you know, just stellar mm-hmm. results and reception in the state of Kentucky over the last 5 years. And like that, we try to build in insect protection, disease prevention, et cetera, so that one is getting a healthy seed, first off, and a seed that's going to perform well with the kind of wacky weather we tend to have here.
Let's talk some now about, you do a lot of Appalachian reclamation projects, including a really neat project to help the bees. Talk about the scope of that job out there in the mountains.
Well, as one might imagine, in eastern Kentucky, there's an awful lot of acreage given way to surface mining and operations of that nature. And both the government, industry, and everybody works together to reclaim those lands as quickly as possible. And we've gotten involved in that for a number of years now. That probably goes back more than 10 years, but it certainly is a big piece of the operation, where basically what you're faced with is a mine just barren, or a hilltop barren with filings on it, and it's, you know, how do we bring that back? How can we quickly reintroduce wildlife, stop erosion? So we've developed products and specific seeds for that business to bring wildlife into areas much quicker than it had in the past.
Can you spray like a slurry of seed and fertilizer in one swoop?
Oh, it's a great thing. This industrial seeding.
You did 30,000 acres last year alone.
Pretty much. That's based on our sales of tackifier and what we see going out in seed for those types of jobs.
But, and what's tackifier?
Okay. I'll get to that in a
second.
Okay,
sorry.
What these do, Bob, and it's a great thing if you look at it. There's some trucks, big tanks on them. The largest ones are maybe 3,500 to 4,000 gallons. And into that will go maybe 2,000 gallons of water, a ton of cellulose, fiber, paper mulch. Per acre, about in some cases 500 pounds of seed, and in other cases up to 2 tons of seed in that tank. And then we mix things like liquid lime to make a nice pH adjustment in those areas that aren't that fertile, etc. And all of this is blended and mixed for about 15 minutes. And there's also a product called a tackifier that goes in there, and that helps the whole slurry set once it's sprayed.
Okay.
Now, a 4,000-gallon machine will spray almost a complete acre. Basically, it's like a concrete mixer that sprays. Mm-hmm. It'll spray up to 100 yards on either side. And you'll see them a lot along the highways, but in reclamation areas where it's difficult to see, difficult to put things down, spraying it on is just a wonderful alternative.
And does it prove to be successful in terms of germination and efficacy in the long run?
It has been. I mean, we've not seen failures.
Okay.
But that's largely, you know, testimony too to the fact that we do provide the good ingredients that you can pretty much count on our result. And the second thing is we're working with contractors and folks out there that are particularly responsible in how they prepare the ground, etc. And once that's taken care of, a good application will do the rest.
And then talk about the wildlife seeds and the bees.
Yeah, a couple of years back, we started looking at just wildlife in general and what could we do. And basically, that was from our standpoint. We're looking at eroding farm acreage. We're looking just, erosion's probably not the thing, but a smaller supply, a dwindling supply of fertile ground that's giving away to urban sprawl, etc. So we thought, well, what can we do for wildlife? And at that time, there were a number of companies coming in that were actually on behalf of the hunters growing things to attract wildlife. And we thought, well, the hunting thing is fine, but, you know, we're more interested in wildlife. You know, how do we bring them back to these areas? So we started where we start, went to the University of Kentucky and talked to some gentlemen there who were particularly helpful and quite open about their opinions of other products that were out there. So we feel we were able to develop for the customer and the end user two mm-hmm. great varieties of seed mixes that bring in a number of deer, mm-hmm. turkey, etc.
So what are these mixes?
And there's a spring mix and a fall mix, and we have some specialty items in there beyond the usual. Mm-hmm. Spinach tends to be very good, Illinois bundle flower, mm-hmm. several other ingredients that really make it a top choice mix.
Mm-hmm.
It was not very soon after that, but shortly after that, we had started reading, like many folks, I think, stories about colony collapse disorder. At the time, I had just kind of a personal affectation for beekeeping. I don't know where that came from, but it's always neat. And interestingly enough, our CEO was about to embark on, you know, getting some bees started. Mm. So he already has his beekeeping operation set up as a hobby. But in doing research for that, starting at UKY and moving on to Eastern mm-hmm. Kentucky and Kentucky State, we were introduced to this interesting initiative whereby they were introducing bees to these locations where mines were being reclaimed on these mine sites. So the bees there had great access to a lot of good flowering plants mm-hmm. on almost a year-round basis, the kind of food they like that more or less is blooming from spring to fall. And,
so you developed a seed mixture specifically to help sustain bee populations in these reclaimed areas.
Right.
Okay.
And we usually do that on demand.
Mm-hmm. You know, so beyond all the seed mixtures, agricultural products, vegetables, etc., you're also working in the area of biostimulants and fertilizers, of course. But, you know, there's an increase, I guess, an interest, increase in demand in more of a biological or botanical sort of approach to some of these things. So how has Caudill Seed sort of taken that under?
Sure. In specific industries, you know, you see waxing and waning of things. But frankly, we do distribute an awful lot of bag fertilizer, mm-hmm. most of it directed toward the homeowners. So it's something easy to handle. You know, you're not storing a lot of product or things like that. And we also supply a lot of professional turf type programs in that category, mm-hmm. golf courses, etc., and there's specialty fertilizers for them as well. You know, we're real big on doing as much as we can for the animals as naturally as we can, so we've been recommending, you know, increased amounts of a liquid lime product or a liming product.
Mm-hmm.
Often we find with our climate here recently that there are things just atmospherically that are preventing some things from growing or changing the soil profile to a point where, you know, pH may be off balance or something. So, you know, in many ways, last year and this year are good years to look at that. If one is balancing fertilizer needs and expenses versus, you know, just doing a better job, mm-hmm. Liming does a heck of a thing. Mm-hmm. We've seen fields wake up, you know, with 3 years of fertilizer that hasn't really been taken up by plants just suddenly explode in growth, and it's a tremendous thing to see.
What about the biostimulants?
Basically, it's chemistry-free, almost, plant hormones and growth products that mm-hmm. we put into our own mixture, a blend. It's been on the market now for almost 18 years, still growing very well. Ultimately designed for things like sports turf or specialty turf, baseball fields, baseball diamonds, if you will, football fields, golf courses, places where the turf had to be exceptionally strong, maintain a good resource of strength so that if it's damaged somehow with divots or whatever, cleats, it can be repaired mm-hmm. very quickly.
So, Joe, when you talk about biostimulants,
right.
I understand the use, but like, what's the actual product? And, you know, the name suggests that it's something a little bit more natural than would be otherwise. So, you know, what makes your all's biostimulant special?
Well, basically, ours is just a combination of two or three products. They're mm-hmm. all natural in nature, not entirely organic,
mm-hmm.
but it's both humic acids and some seaweed extracts that provide fundamental nutrients for extremely good root development and for development above the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, we found that, you know, seaweed extracts are traded on the world market. We tend to buy the most expensive. Actually, they're off the coast of Nova Scotia, reputed to be, you know, the deepest part of the ocean where there's the greatest amount of water and air turbulence, the coldest temperatures, etc. And that's where they harvest much of this for the extract itself. And when you bring it terrestrially, it just does some amazing things for plants
it's
and plant
spread like fertilizer. Just
right, or it's sprayed. We have liquid versions as well as a dry version. But we've actually taken that out of that specialty arena. We make some products available for folks in hydro seeding, others, you know, for, you know, just homeowner type fertilizer type products.
And then for the human animal, you're working on some interesting broccoli products.
Right, right. As a matter of fact, in 1990, it got involved with a broccoli program. And the idea was that some scientists at a number of universities found that there were a valuable ingredient in broccoli that had a number of, let's just call them anti-carcinogenic properties. And once they had started looking at different varieties of broccoli, they were getting different results of how much of that actual enzyme we were looking for was in there. So as these folks were doing their research, they came to us and said, you know, we'd like you to look at all the mature broccoli varieties on the store shelves and tell us what's what with that, what has content, what doesn't. And we found that most varieties of broccoli at the time didn't have this particular enzyme. And that of those that did, once they grew to maturity or were distributed and cleaned or cooked or whatever, that particular enzyme is almost down to nothing. It was shortly after that that they came back to us and said, well, we'd like to start crossbreeding broccoli, and if you guys would do it, we want to develop a broccoli that is very super high in this one particular, call it an enzyme, but it's actually an isothiocyanate. So you know why I call it an enzyme now. But it's just, you know, molecular chemistry that can really do wonders. So we were able, after 8 years, to produce broccoli, not genetically modified, just straight, you know, crossbreeding, a broccoli variety that's exactly very good with this. And we've given it the name Hopkins.
Okay, actually. So once Hopkins has grown and been harvested, how does it become this broccoli supplement?
Right. Hopkins has never grown as a food-producing plant. It's grown to produce more seed.
Okay.
And out of that seed is where we make the extraction.
Huh.
There are a number of folks have looked at it from different angles, but we find that, you know, interestingly enough, the particular isothiocyanate we're looking for is actually there because it's a huge growth mechanism for the plant itself. And so it's going to be there in the greatest quantities before the plant blooms, right, or cracks. So we take it directly from the seed.
So could you eat the seed and get the same benefits, or would it does it have to be, you know, extracted in this form?
The answer to that is yes and no.
Okay.
You could eat the seed and get very good benefits, but there are some downsides to broccoli tends to have a very high oil content before it's cooked. And not all of that oil is very good for you.
Okay.
So we try to dispel that. A lot of folks came to us and said, wow, you got a broccoli cooking oil now. And it's like, no, you don't really want to do that with broccoli oil.
Okay, so in addition to the broccoli supplement, you also have gotten very involved in sprouting seeds. Talk about that a little bit.
We got involved in that early on. In fact, it was another kind of offshoot of one of our CEO's activities where he got involved in the sprouting business. And this was early on, quite a bit of time ago. And we had just discovered the small industry, and it looked like it was kind of small and tiny and tidy and neat that we could work with it. And we started supplying. You know, at the time, actually, there was a lot of growth of Eastern-type restaurants, establishments, and as that grew, the need for sprouts and those types of foods grew. So we got more and more involved in it. I think the thing that really put us over the top was when, in the pre-organic days, folks started approaching us for chemistry-free seed, or chemical-free seed. And we were able to pretty much secure the market on that. Again, from China or other areas that didn't have a big agribusiness-type culture behind them, but still had a lot of fields that qualified as organic. So very quickly, we became one of the largest, hemispherically, the largest distributor of those organic seeds and beans for sprouting. The other thing we do, and if I can put in a plug is, you know, we do everything we do is through distributors, et cetera, but, you know, we always have the ultimate customer in mind. And over the past several years, we've developed two very nice turf grasses that have been particularly strong here in their performance, both in Zone 6 across the country, but particularly here in Kentuckiana, so to speak.
And one what are our, they?
One is Triple Crown.
Yes, and that's the mix.
Right. Okay. That is a blend of three very good fescues. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And the next is what we call Forest Green, okay, named after our founder.
Sure.
But Forest Green, interesting variety of turf tall fescue for lawns. Extremely uniform in blade width, coloration, consistent color across the season, which you don't see very often, but you actually see it green up a little faster in the spring and holds its green color a little longer when the temperatures start to go south on us.
All right. So, Joe, most of these things that we've talked about here, people can find at their local garden centers, at their local, you know, you guys are developing it, distributing it, that sort of thing to all these other retail areas. So
right, we have a lot of great retailers in the Louisville area immediately and throughout the state.
Okay.
We also do a lot of work, you know, in hardware stores and things like that, other places that will have ancillary connection to things like that. Okay. And, of course, feed stores are big.
Well, Joe, it's fascinating. Thank you very much. Enjoyed it.
Thank you, Joe.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you very much. And it's nice to associate faces with voices.
Joe Lyons directs the Caudill Seed Plantwise Division and helps manage the Caudill Seed Health Division. For more information on Joe or his work at Caudill Seed, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
After the break, more from the Caudill Seed Company. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And we are, I know where we are, but it's like it doesn't give it justice just to say that we're at Caudill Seed.
No, it doesn't.
Because it's almost a campus, an expanse area of different types of businesses and product. And we just finished a tour with Del Thacker of the whole alternatives, health food part of the whole thing. Fascinating. I mean, most people that listen to Homegrown know my obsession with food.
That's the word.
So I had a great time.
And health food, in my dad.
Well, I mean, you know, just by chance. But I had a great time sort of seeing the behind-the-scenes sort of thing. So we're going to share that with you. Del Thacker is with us right now.
Yeah, Del worked for Hershey Foods for 28 years, managing plants in Kansas and California and Louisville before taking charge of the Caudill Seed Whole Alternatives Division of the company's health food division. He's with us today to talk about everyone's concern, health foods. Del, welcome to Homegrown.
Thanks, Bob.
Let's begin with kind of an overview of the Caudill Whole Alternatives Health Foods program. What's its history and what do you have in mind with this thing?
Well, we got into the health food business around 18 years ago, basically in beans and just things that's grown on the farm, beans, corn, things of that nature. Then that grew into more of a packaged business where we do popcorn, organic popcorn and natural popcorn, and we do dried fruits and nuts. That evolved into more and more business into the canned goods area, sugars, different things of that nature.
Mm-hmm. And now you're shipping millions and millions of packages every year. The scale of this place is amazing. Anybody's ever driven down Main Street and wondered what was going on behind the doors, it's really something. Talk about how you get your certified organic foods. How does that work?
Well, we're certified by an organization that will come into our plant once a year. They take 2 days to inspect the plant to make sure that we are following their rules, Quality Assurance International. And one of the things, they make sure that we use no pesticides, that our plant is free of any fumigants or anything of that nature, that our products, as they come in, are certified organic, that they're bug-free, obviously, and wholesome.
When we look at all the different product that you guys are dealing with now, you know, you kind of started with rice and beans, that sort of thing, and now you have more like gourmet items in terms of nuts and dried fruit and that sort of thing. Was that just something that you all chose to do as a business, or is this something that the customer started to demand and you really needed to fill that niche?
It was customer demands and growth. We look at what we call line item extensions. That's where we want to give the customer more of an opportunity to buy more things from us to grow our business. Pine Nuts is a good example. Pine Nuts in most stores, as you see, runs right at $20 a pound. Mm-hmm. We package them for several stores in 4 ounces, and of course, I don't know what they sell them for, but I'm sure they make a reasonable profit off of it. But we grow our business that way. Like now we're doing mac and cheese. We do canned soups. And what we want to be is more of a one-stop shop for our customer. Mm-hmm. Say that one of the grocery chains in the Northwest was only buying one item from us, then that means there's only one item that we could put on that truck and maybe not fill that truck up. We have grown that to 240 SKUs. An SKU is a unit of items that we have. So we have over 240 different items that we sell at the different stores now.
So is it fair to say that you guys are essentially like the middleman? You get the product from somebody else, it's here, or you do something to it here, and then you sell it wholesale to the retailer.
Absolutely. We try to add value to any of the products that we buy. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we will do is we'll take an item and put it in a resellable bag, or we'll put it in a pouch, a stand-up pouch, to make it more attractive to the customer. We are, our basic business is a private label. Say there's a large chain in Florida that wants their own label. We'll buy an item. We label their package with their name on it, the items they want in it, and sometimes the mixture that they want of items. Mm-hmm. So it looks like they did it.
Okay.
Yeah, Del, the scope of the food chain always amazes me. You're buying sugar from South America. You're getting product from China. You're getting things from all over the world coming to Main Street in Louisville and repackaging. How do you find product in South America and China? How's this work?
Well, normally it's an item we're looking for. In other words, like in the organic side, I guess last year one of the hottest items going was a goji berry, and it was the health mm-hmm. thing for the first right. part of the year. And we knew that goji berries were basically made in China, and organic goji berries especially. And one of the reasons that the organic goji berry comes from China is that most of the people in China farm organically because they can't afford to farm any other way. so we get them from China. But it's also the only source that we have for that particular item. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of customer demand. The customer will call us and they'll want agave, which is a form of sweetener that comes from the cactus. Mm-hmm. It's a natural sweetener. It's organic. And they use it, I think, for tequila is what they use it mm-hmm. for. But we have some customers that want to use it as a sweetener like honey. So we're getting into agave. But most of it is where a customer wants something, and then we go out and try to find it.
Mm-hmm. So it's like shipped to California, mm-hmm. truck to Louisville, comes to Main Street, goes into your plant. You turn around, put it in smaller packages and labels, and send it back out again all over the world again.
Right, right. We do probably, as I was saying, about 240 different labels for some about 45 different customers across the country in different items. We also do trail mixes, which you see, and we'll put cashews mm-hmm. or different kind of nuts in trail mixes, and they're custom blends. Let's say you were a store that really the demographics were that you weren't in a rich neighborhood, but you still wanted to sell a trail mix to a customer. What we would do is rather than putting whole cashews into there, we'd put bits and pieces, which would make it cheaper for us to sell to you, which you could mm-hmm. in turn sell it to your customer at a less cost.
Mm-hmm. So, Del, do you all sell anything in bulk, or is everything packaged in some form or fashion?
No, we sell anywhere from 4 ounces to 2,000 pounds. Okay. We have 2,000 pound totes of popcorn, broccoli seed, mung beans. We sell in 50 pound bags. We have the ability here to rebag, take out 2,000 pound bags, clean it, put in 25 or 50 pound bags. We sell in 5 pound food service size and 10 pound food service size.
So that would be like for restaurants and that
restaurants,
sort of thing?
Restaurants, yeah. Okay. Reclosable. We have probably 25 different packing formations that we use.
Hmm. Let's talk some about popcorn, which is near and dear to my basketball fan's heart because I can't watch a game or a movie without popcorn.
And one of their biggest sellers.
That is our biggest seller.
So you'll bring a lot in here, but then you put it under different labels. And it can be organic. It can also be
all natural,
organic. We do a variety pack to where there's buttered, there's just the plain popcorn, no salt. We have 100 calorie packs, which is a great thing now because everybody's watching the calories. So what they'll do is the 100-calorie pack. They know that they're eating 100 calories. And in most cases, they'll eat six packs, so they've eaten 600 calories. But at least they know they've eaten 600 calories.
So popcorn is one of your biggest sellers, as we mentioned. What's the process for that? Like, where do you get the actual the corn from? And then how does it get turned into, you know, what the consumer finally buys?
Because popcorn is our biggest seller, we probably track it a lot closer than anything else. We actually go to the farms in Nebraska, Indiana. We have some in Texas and some in California. We make sure that in organics, the ground has to be pesticide-free for 3 years. We make sure of that. We make sure that they are certified, and we get our certification letter with every load that comes in. When we get the corn into the plant here, it's inspected and cleaned, then it gets packed.
Okay. And then labeled for whoever's...
For whichever customer we're presenting to.
Because I noticed that some of the packages were in French, and they go to Canada, right? French-Canadian provinces. So is there any sort of different regulations that you all have to comply with because it's going out of the country?
No, not really. The only thing we have to make sure is, just like here, that it is organic, mm-hmm. certified, and it's bilingual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
we have to put the labels on there. And one of our customers that we send to in Canada is probably one of the largest suppliers of popcorn, microwave popcorn. And they buy somewhere around 1 million pounds a year of popcorn.
Wow.
Yeah, and you have a very loyal staff here. You're very proud of that, in fact. And I noticed just walking around the factory, a lot of interaction between the boss and the
Everybody
workers.
Everybody smiled and said hello to him.
Yeah, right. Even beyond being the boss, I think they sort of liked you a little bit. So,
yeah, our co-workers are really the heart of our business. We have 130 people in the whole alternative division. And it's not just the whole alternative division. It's every division of Caudill Seed. We hire second-chance people from different places around town, people that's had problems in the past, and give them a second chance. And I have to say that it's a very good way to do business. If companies out there aren't doing it, they should be. We have a dedicated staff. We have systems in place, and these people are used to rules and regulations. They do a great job, never miss work. Very seldom are they sick.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, because it is their opportunity, they take advantage of it.
Mm-hmm.
We do a lot for them, and they do a lot for us. There's a lot of pride. We have a lot of things that we ask them to do. They work all the hours we need. They're there. They're great employees.
So since you had alluded earlier to, you know, customers will say they want something, so you go out and you find it for them, right?
Right.
So do you find that some of these things, especially in the whole food sort of movement, all natural and organic, that finding some of these things proved to be somewhat of a challenge, you know, to meet all of those specs?
Yeah, and some items it's very challenging, and one of the reasons is we try to, as much as we can, buy things local or buy things that's processed in the United States. But when you get into organics, a lot of farmers don't want to go into organics, and one of the reasons is because of the rules and regulations. They have to be QAI certified.
And also just the sheer bulk that you all would need? Does that play a part or not necessarily?
Not necessarily. And one of the things that was that way a couple of years ago, and what we have done in the last couple of years is we've spread out the amount of especially popcorn that we buy across 7 or 8 different farmers.
Okay.
We have 100 acres or 200 acres that we grow in Nebraska. We have 300 acres we grow in Indiana, 50 acres in Texas, 150 acres in California. And one of the problems with the farmer is they really don't want to tie land up for 3 years. When you decide you want to go into organic farming, you have to leave that land vacant for at least 3 years to leach any pesticides or anything in it out for a long period of time. The other thing is you have to watch and not be too close to non-organic crops because you worry about cross-contamination. Mm-hmm. Some of the larger farmers, which is what we try to buy from, the larger the crop, the less we worry about cross-contamination. Mm-hmm. They say that in corn, the farmer should take the first 20 rows of corn and uses commercial, because if there's anything coming in, it'll catch in the first 20 rows. So there's a lot of difficulties of doing it, and a lot of farmers just don't want to do it, and I understand it.
But, Dale, given your 30 years in the business, looking back to where organic foods were, health foods were then, and now, do you see a bright future for the product?
I think so, and I believe one of the things I was reading today is that, I think this year alone there was 3 million cases of kids under 18 years old that were allergics, have allergies to some form or the other. And I think that a lot of that is because of the not having the organics, or because we're such a clean society right now. And I think you'll see it growing as we go. But I think we will lose the niche buyer. That's the person that just sees it, thinks it's a neat thing to do, and buys it. We have three types of customer. We have the niche buyer who sees it advertised as organic and likes it, so they're going to buy it. We have the 60s person who has been doing that since 1960 and is not going to stop. And then we have the people now who's reading about the organics and about the safe benefits of organic without the pesticides and these. So I think we'll continue to grow. We may not grow at 25%, but I think we'll see continued growth in the 10 to 15% range. But as that happens, you also see line item extensions where there's organic mac and cheese. There'll be more things available organic.
Well, Dale, thanks. It's been fun and an interesting tour. And
super duper interesting. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
It really is
a
Louisville icon and nobody really knows it. Dale Thacker manages the Caudill Seed Whole Alternatives Division. For more information on Dale or the company or its product, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, we peruse the catalogs for some interesting plants, plus another chapter in Bob's Plant Stories. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Catalog Bob Hill.
Yep, we're down here on West Main.
Yep.
At Caudill Seed Company, and have enjoyed our visit and our tours, to be sure. And we've decided to do something a little different today, Bob, and we'll probably revisit this over the course of the next couple of weeks as well. We instructed one another to bring in some interesting plants that we've found in catalogs.
Exactly.
Because it's catalog season. And people start to get excited, and they're curious about what they should pick or what they shouldn't, that sort of thing. So what are your picks this week?
Yeah, I've got three shrubs. One of them is one great one called Nine Bark, which I really like. It's Physocarpus is the Latin on it. It's fairly new. It's been around maybe 10 or 15 years. The first one was called Diablo. It was real tall. The joy of this plant is it's got a beautiful deep burgundy purple leaf almost all year with a really cool kind of chocolate white flower and exfoliating bark. In the winter, and it's supposed to peel to nine layers.
Hence is that why it's nine bark?
Yeah, hence the nine bark. It probably only goes seven or nine, I don't know, but nine barks. But it's really a fun plant. There's a
it
lot.
It doesn't actually bark.
No, it kind of goes meow. Another one I love the name of is the Viburnum nudum.
I got it's a fabulous shrub.
I got it in my nudum camp. It's got it's got a real bright, shiny leaf. But the best thing about it is in the fall, you get these bright pink berries that kind of turn blue, and they hang there together. And you have this mass of pink and blue berries on this shiny green leaf that gives great fall color.
It's a great shrub.
Third one is one called Father Gilia, which I really like a lot, too. It blooms early spring. It's got this big, beautiful, honey-like flower and a great fall color. It gets 3 to 4 feet tall. But this mass of spiky kind of white flowers when you least expect it before the leaves come on. So it's just kind of got this dance of white on top of it. It's really a great plant.
Yeah,
Father
nice.
Gilia.
And good fall color, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
How about you?
My perennial picks. I had Bob had shrubs and I had perennials. Three perennials that I think people should really look at to put into their perennial gardens in the spring. Kind of underused. Nadia.
Oh, yeah.
Do you have Nadia?
Yes.
Nadia Macedonica, yep. I believe. Yep. Great plant. Once it gets established, you know, all this stuff is really going to be pretty easy to grow once they get established. But, you know, the first couple of years, give them some water if it doesn't rain. So Nadia is one. And let's see, Stokes Aster.
Oh, boy.
Or Stokesia.
The blue flower of those guys. Beautiful.
Really nice. And I don't see these in people's gardens very much, do you?
Yeah.
Kind of a low-growing, lance-shaped foliage, kind of thick. If it's not too cold of a winter, actually, that rosette of lance-shaped leaves persists, but then bright kind of aster-like but thicker and larger blooms in the summer. Shallow-rooted, so if it's a really hot, dry summer, you may need to water it.
But it comes back a little in the fall, too.
Hmm?
Mine will rebloom a little bit
really?
In the fall.
Really? I don't have that so much, unless I'm diligent about deadheading
it. Yeah,
so
deadheading it. It's a great plant.
Yeah. Third plant, Campanula Sarastro.
Oh, one of my favorites.
But Sarastro, it's so robust.
Right.
And it really spread, and it bloomed all summer, and it's these very large, kind of purplish, weird kind of purple color, though.
Yeah.
Kind of fleshy, thick-looking blooms that are like lanterns that hang down.
It's like a living garden party.
Yeah,
I love that plant. Yeah.
So Sarastro, Campanula, Stokes Aster, Stokesia, or Nadia.
We'll have these plants listed on our website. And next week we'll have annuals and trees.
Yeah. And if you do have questions, of course, you can get a hold of us by going to our website at wfpl.org. That's right. Bob, it's a plant story day. What do you have for us?
For you, Miss Wishy, I'll begin with the Latin word first.
All right.
Poa pratensis.
Poa is grass, some sort of grass,
yep.
Right? Isn't that like bluegrass?
Sounds like Hawaii food, but it's Kentucky bluegrass. Right on schedule here. Obviously, it's well known here, the whole state, and we got the thoroughbred horse thing and Bill Monroe and Orange Blossom Special and Kentucky bluegrass music. People think it was invented here in Kentucky. Nope. It's a different story. It's a native of Europe, Northern Asia.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
The mountains of Algeria and Morocco.
Wow.
It's been around for hundreds of years, if not thousands of years. Here's how we know this. Poa is a classical Greek word meaning grass or pasture grass.
Uh-huh.
Pratensis is from the Latin pratum, meaning a meadow or growing in a meadow.
Right.
So
it was like their short grass prairie over there, I guess, was their bluegrass.
Yeah, and it's been around for hundreds, if not thousands of years, and the story, they think, is it came over here with the settlers because allegedly William Penn had it growing in his yard in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm. But it didn't originally grow like it grows now, does it?
No, it kind of spread.
Okay.
It kind of spread when it got here.
Okay.
I couldn't really find the exact story. I looked for about 2 hours.
Yeah.
I couldn't find any specific reference to why it's called Kentucky bluegrass.
Hmm.
So if anybody out there knows a specific story, I'll be glad to hear it. Because although one guy called it typical American arrogance.
I thought it was because it was so, like, it was bluish when it blew in the wind.
We'll get to that.
We'll get
to that. But it's now found in 50 states, both domestic and wild. The truth is it's a lousy grass
to grow grass
in this
Kentucky.
Part of the country.
The truth is.
Because it's got shallow roots. It likes cooler, moist climates. Doesn't like droughts particularly well. In fact, the root growth peaks at 60 degrees. Slows at 70 degrees and stops at 80 degrees.
Whoops.
This is not
Kentucky.
Yeah, Kentucky Anna. Bluegrass doesn't belong here. But they're trying. There's about 100 cultivars of varieties of Kentucky bluegrass or bluegrass, some that take the heat better than others. Where it gets its name is it's not the bluegrass, but the seed heads.
Ah, yes.
If you let it grow to 2 or 3 feet and look at it, and I'm going to do that this year as an experiment.
I don't have any bluegrass.
I'm going to plant some Kentucky bluegrass.
And let it grow.
Let it grow to 3 feet.
Excellent.
And take a picture of it and
see
if it's actually blue. Because it's
the
seed
head.
It's not the grass.
Gotcha.
And actually, most of the bluegrass seed farms are in Idaho, Oregon, and Washington.
Where it's cooler.
And they're probably shipped right here to Caudill Seed from there. I'm sure
probably.
They are, in fact. Yeah. But it comes with a poem.
All right,
another
good.
Ironic poem. What's supposed to be seen near Lexington's white fences is what the old Greeks called poa pratensis. A plant often praised as Kentucky bluegrass, but the blue can't be seen till it reaches your belt buckle. It's a grass with a story, a history of past, whose reach often exceeds the lawnmower's grasp. It's a native of Europe and Asia and Morocco and moved to Kentucky a long time ago. Made famous when a local first noticed its hue and shouted in wonder, "Them suckers is blue." So a region was born, and then came the fences and thoroughbred horses that prances and dances. So bluegrass came calling with joy and good cheer. But remember this, folks, you don't plant it here.
Good advice. Tall type fescue is much better, yep. Isn't it, Bob?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Except if you're a hardcore romantic, maybe you can plant a little bluegrass.
You got some arrogance.
Yeah.
We'll find out. I'm going to experiment.
Okay. Thank you very much. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, Gary Nebhan and retracing Nikolai Vavilov's steps and his quest to end famine. And of course, we'd like to thank everybody here at Caudill Seed for hosting us here today.
Homegrown is produced by the Never Blue Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.